Dostoevsky and the Brothers Karamazov was presented by Tim McIntosh at Gutenberg College's 2010 Summer Institute entitled Democracy, a User's Manual. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
In 1837, Fyodor Dostoevsky witnessed a brutal event that he would never forget, an event that would show up repeatedly in his novels and in his personal journals. Dostoevsky was 16 years old. He was sitting at a posting station near St. Petersburg when a wealthy government courier burst into the posting station, gulped down a shot of vodka, rushed outside, leapt into a peasant's carriage, and commanded the peasant to take him to the city. To ensure that the peasant moved quickly and understood his request, the government courier, a wealthy man, beat the peasant hard around the back and neck. And to the same rhythm of the received blows, the peasant beat his horse faster and faster. Dostoevsky imagined that night that the peasant returned home and, to avenge his humiliation, beat his wife to the same tempo as the received blows from the government courier. The 16-year-old Dostoevsky was filled with sympathy for the beaten peasant, who wouldn't be. And the event for him embodied everything that was wrong, not just with Russia, but with Europe. The lower classes, like this peasant coachman, were oppressed and abused by the upper classes. And like many young Russian intellectuals, Dostoevsky was sympathetic with a new movement called socialism or Marxism. Like many, it occurred to me, he later said, that were I ever to found a socialist club, I would engrave the courier's fist on the seal of the society. Marxism was, at its heart, a reaction to the massive effects of the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century. Europe's economy was moving away from a manual labor and draft animal-based economy toward a machine-based manufacturing, and the effects on society were almost immeasurable. Some of the positive effects were it created massive amounts of wealth and gave birth to a burgeoning middle class, spreading economic opportunity beyond the aristocracy. Some of the negative effects of the Industrial Revolution we may be a little bit more familiar with. Many farm-based workers found employment in mills and factories, but often under very strict working conditions, at a pace set no longer by nature, but my machines. I remember reading a book and just thinking about how different the world was when your clock was the sun and instead your clock became the whistle of the industry, the whistle of the factory. I mean, just psychologically, what a profound change that was. Under the strict working conditions, throngs of workers moved from foreign secreted factories. Many factory workers worked 13 to 15-hour days. And after work, they would retreat into overpacked slum, sometimes two families, three families sharing one room. This is a section from Charles Dickens' Hard Times. It was a town of red brick, or of brick that would have been red if the smoke and ashes had allowed it. But as matters stood, it was a town of unnatural red and black, like the painted face of a savage. It was a town of machinery and tall chimneys, out of which interminable serpents of smokes trailed themselves forever and ever and never got uncoiled. It had a river that ran purple with ill-smelling dye, and vast piles of buildings full of windows where there was a rattling and a trembling all day long. Into these terrible conditions, Marxism offered a critique and a solution. Industrialized society, said Karl Marx, had split society into two classes. Well, it was already split into two classes, but it reinforced this. The bourgeoisie, and who are the bourgeoisie? Those of you who know Marxism well. Casey, who are the bourgeoisie? They're the masters. They own the means of production, the factory owners. And the much larger lower class, who are the lower class? the proletariat, the ones that actually did the work. Marx saw the industrial revolution as the last gasp of an old feudal order, and soon he predicted or expected the proletariat would rise up, cast off the bourgeois shackles, and become a classless society. The Industrial Revolution would be the precursor to the development of socialism and eventually communism. For Marx, all of history was a story of class struggle, the bourgeois versus the proletariat, and the time had come for the proletariat to rise up. This seemed an obvious truth to Dostoevsky, who had witnessed class warfare not only at the trading post, but at his school. He went to the Academy of Military Engineers, where he was trained to be a draftsman. And warfare existed there between the upperclassmen and the lowerclassmen. The upperclassmen abused, humiliated, beat the lowerclassmen for even minor infractions. And the administrators of the academy did little to curb such abuses, provided that their ranks remained orderly and disciplined. Thus, Dostoevsky, who was raised a Christian and who was a fervent Christian at this time, spent much of his intellectual daydreaming conjoining Christianity with socialism. For him, Christ was a semi-secular leader who demanded social renewal, who wanted a classless society, just working conditions, and his triumph would be, Dostoevsky believed, attained through revolutionary violence. Dostoevsky didn't wait for a revolution to happen in Russia. In fact, he began practicing it when he was at the military academy. He joined forces with friends to resist the abuses of the schools, and Dostoevsky and his friends were remembered by classmates later for their compassion for the poor, the weak, the unprotected, and for even taking up the cause of some of the teachers at his school, which liked to be, some of the upperclassmen used to like to make fun of some of the tutors because they were a little bit older, dithering, and Dostoevsky and his friends did not like this at all. After graduating, Dostoevsky began to write. For years, he labored over his first novel, which was entitled Poor Folk. I think there's a slide of that somewhere in there, Sam. One more. 1846. Poor Folk is a series of letters, fictitious letters, exchanged between two cousins. Each letter attests to their terrible living conditions, lost jobs, depression, and alcoholism. One of their sons groans in hunger throughout the story, gently crying himself to sleep at night. When published, I'm not going to try to say his first name, Belinsky, a prominent socialist critic of the time, praised Dostoevsky's work as a work of genius, a novel with a true social conscience. And this was Dostoevsky was welcomed into the literati of his time with open arms. He was heralded. 1 year after publishing Poor Folk, Dostoevsky was welcomed into a particular socialist society that David mentioned earlier, but the Petrushevsky Circle. The following year, after Dostoevsky joined the circle, next slide, Sam, 1848, Europe exploded. This year is sometimes called the Year of Revolution or the Spring of Nations. Political upheaval swept through France, Italy, the German states, Hungary, Poland, Switzerland, Denmark, and the Habsburg Empire. Despite forceful and often violent efforts of the established powers to keep them down, the new ideas gained popularity and traction. The new ideas, democracy, liberalism, and socialism. Now I'm going to pause here and define what these words mean in 1848. This is probably going to be a good habit for us because when we say socialism now, it's probably something fairly different from what Dostoevsky was talking about in 1848 or what the utopian socialists were advocating in 1848. The word democracy at this time meant simply universal male suffrage, voting rights for all males. Liberalism at this time meant consent of the governed and restriction of church and state power. Socialism did not have so clear a definition, but meant broadly power for the workers in a collectivist system. Communism, which was quickly gaining sharper definition since the Communist Manifesto was published this same year, was defined by Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto. What is the chief differences between socialism and communism? The socialist favored reforms, the communist favored revolution. Socialists, according to Marx, didn't recognize the preeminent role of the working class. The socialists were weak, Marx thought. Cowards, wouldn't go the whole way. The communists did recognize the preeminent role of the working class. Marx thought socialism was not for real men, let's just say it like that. It took a real man to be a full-fledged communist. But for our purposes, the difference between the socialists and the communists by the end of the 1800s is not terribly significant. Thus, when Dostoevsky speaks of socialism, he means something not altogether different from communism. So, returning to 1848, revolutions are taking place across Europe, but much to Dostoevsky and his friends' chagrin, they do not happen in Russia. Dostoevsky and his friends read about the revolutions in the papers and bemoaned that no revolution had erupted at home. Why there was no revolution in Russia is a source of debate. Historians agree there are many different factors. One of the main factors is that the revolutionary groups all throughout Russia basically just couldn't communicate with each other like they could in France or in Germany. One prominent Russian socialist, Mikhail Petrushevsky, next slide, Sam, could not stand for the fact that Russia had not experienced a revolt. He aggressively criticized Tsar Nicholas I. He advocated reformation of the courts, freedom of the press, abolition of serfdom, which was a significant deal considering that more than half of Russia's populace at this time was serf. Basically, they were an owned people, owned by the aristocracy. And Petrushevsky began to clamor for revolution. Quote, "We have sentenced the present social order to death. Now we must carry out that sentence." And he demanded Nicholas I pay attention. Nicholas I did pay attention. Nicholas I planned and executed the arrest of the Petrushevsky circle not long after a young socialist named Fyodor Dostoevsky had joined their group. They were a discussion group of progressive intellectuals. And a little after 4 in the morning, on April 22nd, 1849, an officer burst into Dostoevsky's room to tell him that he was under arrest, charged with participating in a subversive political alliance. His captors urged him to forswear his belief in socialism and to give them names of other socialists, which he refused to do. And he was taken to trial. The court found him guilty of various seditious acts. And 3 days before Christmas on 1849, Dostoevsky, 28 years old, was marched into a snowy field with the rest of the Petrushevsky circle. It was a snowy field near St. Petersburg. And the soldiers loaded their weapons, took aim, and then there was a long, long silence. Apparently the wind was blowing so hard that Dostoevsky could barely hear the sentence being read, and he never really said what he thought about during the time when the muskets were loaded and pointed at him, but we can all imagine what we might think. Finally, the silence was broken not by gunshots, but by horse hooves. A messenger had arrived bearing word from Tsar Nicholas himself. The prisoners' lives were to be spared. That was the good news. The bad news. They were all going to Siberia. Hard labor. The original sentence for Dostoevsky was 8 years hard labor. It was later, by Nicholas I, trimmed down to 4. Some members of the Petrushevsky circle were really resentful. You get the feeling that they wanted to suffer a martyr's death. One of them ended up going insane. Dostoevsky was overjoyed, wrote letters to his brother just explaining how in love with life he was now that he had got a chance to live it. Dostoevsky, as I said, spent 4 years in Siberia. He went in a Christian socialist. He came out, and he kept the title Christian, no longer a socialist. What changed? In short, one thing changed his mind, his opinion about the serfs. Go one more, Sam. Entering Siberia, Dostoevsky saw them as the simple people, the people of the land, oppressed and befouled by the cruel fist of the bourgeoisie. But what he experienced in Siberia destroyed that belief. The serfs were just as violent, vindictive, and murderous as the upper class. They stole from each other, beat each other, cheated each other, and even raped each other. Quote, "They would have eaten us alive if given a chance," said Dostoevsky. His change of mind was much more fundamental than a shift in political philosophy. Siberia changed his view about human nature. The serfs' sins were not the result of upper-class oppression. There was something intrinsically wrong, not just with the serfs, not just with the upper class, but with humanity. Furthermore, Dostoevsky recognized this malignancy in his own being. "There were moments when I hated everybody I came across, innocent or guilty, and looked at them as thieves who were robbing me of my life with impunity. The most unbearable misfortune is when you yourself become unjust, malignant, vile. You realize it. You even reproach yourself, but you just can't help it. Amid the squalor and brutality and impossible labor, Dostoevsky experienced a moment of rebirth." Next slide, Sam. It happened during Pascha, a Roman Orthodox holiday. Instead of seeing his fellow soldiers with spite and hatred, he saw them as his brothers in Christ. Quote, "The convicts took their prayers very seriously, and each time they came to church, each one of them would buy a candle or contribute to the collection. I am somebody too, was what they thought. Everyone is equal before God. We took communion at the early Mass when, with the chalice in his head, the priest came with the words, Receive me, O Lord, even as the robber. Nearly all of the convicts fell to the ground with a jangling of chains, apparently interpreting these words as literal expression of their own thoughts." After 4 years of hard labor in Siberia, Dostoevsky spent several months in military exile before being freed to return to St. Petersburg. These years from 1854 to 1871 were almost as difficult as his time in Siberia. They were brutal. You might know that Dostoevsky was an epileptic, apparently suffered pretty frequent seizures. Thanks, Sam. You're on it. He also, during this time, got married. His marriage was a disaster full of heartaches and feuds. And it ended when Maria, that was her name, died of consumption in 1857. Dostoevsky was what we might call today a problem gambler. He faced constant debt, much of which occurred from gambling. And some people think that he wrote Crime and Punishment largely to pay off this hanging debt that he had over him. He wrote it really quickly, which is incredible when you think about how good it is that he wrote it in haste. His second marriage to Anna, 10 years later, was much happier than his first, but his life was still with he still suffered greatly. To outpace his creditors, he and his second wife Anna moved to Europe, where the Dostoevskys never felt at home. While in Europe, Anna conceived and gave birth to Sonia, a little girl whose existence apparently just delighted Dostoevsky. He was consumed with sitting her on his lap and just watching her every little gesture. When she was 3 months old, however, she caught cold, which grew quickly worse, and she died. 3 months old. Dostoevsky was devastated, and the Europe, which he did not enjoy to begin with, seemed even colder and darker than before, so he and Anna resolved to return home to Russia. During his time in Europe, Dostoevsky's convictions had deepened. In the last novels of Dostoevsky's life, Crime and Punishment and Brothers Karamazov included, were written mostly after his return to Russia, and they explore the effect of Europe's intellectual theories upon the psyche of the Russian people. Europe, as he saw it, had fallen in love with inhuman philosophies, and he feared that these isms, atheism, Marxism, nihilism, would infiltrate and doom his mother Russia. His hope that Russia would reject them and, through belief in God, be spared the doom that surely he believed would visit Europe. Dostoevsky's gift as a writer, it is said, was that he was able to feel ideas. He did not just think them, but he felt them, and it shows up in his work. Thus, his writings make the readers feel the effects of the various isms that were visiting upon Europe. The section we read from Brothers Karamazov are, in a way, fairly atypical of Dostoevsky's writings because at least a couple of them are long monologues. His great gift as a writer is burrowing into the psyche of his characters and being so true and accurate with their psychology that you feel that you are experiencing what they are experiencing. You almost feel that Dostoevsky is on your shoulder, kind of perched and looking into your mind and experiencing what you're experiencing. So if you have not read any other Dostoevsky, don't let these sections deter you, because his great strength is as a psychologist, a man who peers so deeply into the mind, like I said, that you feel like he's reading your thoughts as he writes. Nietzsche and Freud, two master psychologists in their own rights, and neither one of them Christians, both hailed Dostoevsky as without parallel in his psychological insight. Freud apparently couldn't read Dostoevsky because he said that his characters were too much like the patients that he was treating, lurching back and forth to all sorts of different positions at a moment's notice. Nietzsche said that the only psychologist he ever learned anything from was Dostoevsky. Crime and Punishment tells the story of Raskolnikov, who is a cross between two of Europe's isms. He is an atheist and a nihilist who believes himself above the law. He believes he is superior to the common lot of man and thus has the right to murder. His interior dialogue in the book is absolutely maddening. One moment he views himself as a superman, a Nietzschean superman, not accountable to the law. The next he's a dithering coward who's afraid to leave his room. One moment he's the gracious protector of a weak and innocent person. The next minute he is the warrior against the weak and innocent. His psyche is like a fraying rope twisting under his inhuman philosophy. If Crime and Punishment is about a man who denies God's existence to justify a murder, the Brothers Karamazov is about a man denying not God, but the meaning of God's creation. It's not that I don't believe in God, Ivan tells his brother Alyosha. It's just that I returned the ticket. This was the status of the European intellectual scene in the late 19th century. No longer were European intellectuals concerned about God's existence. That was off the table. Their concerns, instead, were confined to this plane of existence, this world. Quote, I have long resolved not to think about whether man created God or God man, Ivan tells Alyosha. Such a question is utterly inappropriate for a man like me, who only thinks in three dimensions, meaning this world. In The Rebellion, Ivan challenges Alyosha's devotion to the elder Zosima's world of all-embracing forgiveness and overflowing selfless love. And Ivan unrolls a catalog of atrocities, dwelling for a long time on the torture of the helpless and the innocent children. I suspect some of this novel was hard to read, And this, it has to be admitted, is part of Dostoevsky's genius as a writer also. What separates him from the thousands of mediocre authors who leave no impression on the heart of the mind is that he puts into Ivan's mouth the very best argument his opponents can muster and appeals to our deepest human feelings with his opponent. I mean, sometimes when you're reading The Grand Inquisitor, at least for me, and reading The Rebellion, it's hard to think. You start to wonder, is Dostoevsky advocating for this? It's so powerful. This feeling was surely heightened when Dostoevsky wrote this part of the novel, because he and Anna had just lost their second child, 3-year-old Alyosha. Into Ivan's mouth, Dostoevsky has put his opponent's best argument, appealing to our deepest human feelings. And when we read about soldiers catching babies on bayonets, how can we not be moved, repulsed, even indignant at the injustice of this world? Which of us does not feel the same way when an injustice is done to us, or when a sickness creeps into our body, or when we lose a loved one, or when we see a bird crush under the wheels of a car? All of us, I dare say, feel this indignation, an indignation not just that this particular act was unfair, unjust, uncaring, but that this whole place is. All of us, I dare say, have muttered Job's accusation against God, that he laughs at the despair of the innocent, and he has given the world to the wicked and has blindfolded her judges. Indeed, Dostoevsky was surely experiencing the same indignation at the loss of his son, Alyosha. Given that this world is so often unjust, cruel, uncaring, what ought we to do? How should we live our lives, and how should we cope? Ivan's answer is that we should reject this world. We should return the ticket and remain in unrequited suffering and unquenched indignation, even, in the words of Ivan, if I am wrong. Ivan asks Alyosha rhetorically whether there is in the whole world a being who would have the right to forgive and could forgive the evil and injustice of the world. Alyosha quickly replies that Ivan is forgetting Christ, that there is a being, that he can forgive everything and all for all because he gave his innocent blood for all and everything, which prompts Ivan to respond with a story of the Grand Inquisitor. Margaret was in our group, and she said, and I asked, what is Ivan's response to Alyosha when he says, you know, Christ is the answer? And she said, yeah, he laid a trap for him. He was just waiting on him to say Christ that he could roll out the story of the Grand Inquisitor, which he does. The story is recognized as the most famous passage in Dostoevsky's writing and among the most justly famous passages in all modern literature. Dostoevsky said that this chapter was, in fact, the culmination of his literary career, and the entire book, and not just the Elder Zosima section, is meant as a reply, a rebuke, a retort to this section of the book. Ivan's story, The Grand Inquisitor, is placed in 16th century Spain the day after 100 heretics have been burned at the stake. Into this scene, Christ suddenly appears softly, unobserved, and yet, strange to say, everyone recognized him. The Grand Inquisitor, a Catholic priest, but not just a Catholic priest, it's important to remember, his role is not just religious, but also political. Very important to remember that both of those roles are in the one person of the Grand Inquisitor. Orders Christ imprisoned. Christ never utters a word, and his silence goads the Inquisitor into explaining himself, explaining his actions, explaining that he has been forced to correct Christ's work by relieving mankind of its misery. And what is the chief source of that misery? The burden of free will. The Grand Inquisitor said, "Didst thou forget that man prefers peace and even death to freedom of choice in the knowledge of good and evil?" The Inquisitor asks Christ why he has come with empty hands and with some promise of freedom, and why he did not turn these stones in this parched and barren wilderness into bread. Quote, "Turn them into bread, and mankind will run after thee like a flock, grateful and obedient. If Christ will only take command over the human conscience," says the Inquisitor, "but Christ refuses and denies humanity the tranquility of certitude and obedience." I'm going to read a section, page 254. This is the Inquisitor speaking. "For the mystery of man's being is not only in living, but in what lives, but in what one lives for. Without a firm idea of what he lives for, man will not consent to live and will sooner destroy himself than remain on earth, even if there is bread all around him. That is so, but what came of it? Instead of taking over men's freedom, you, Christ, increased it still more for them. Did you not forget that peace and even death are dearer to man than free choice and the knowledge of good and evil? There is nothing more seductive for man than the freedom of his conscience, but nothing is more tormenting either. And so, instead of a firm foundation for appeasing human conscience once and for all, you chose everything that was unusual, enigmatic, and indefinite. You chose everything that was beyond men's strength, and thereby acted as if you did not love them at all. And who did this? He who came to give his life for them? Instead of taking over men's freedom, you increased it and forever burdened the kingdom of the human soul with its torments. The Grand Inquisitor's solution is to take that freedom away from man and to thus do them a big favor. That's so he thinks. The charge that the Grand Inquisitor lays against Alyosha is no small one. It is this: given that this world is so hard, that Christianity demands we freely examine our conscience, that following God demands that we view some of our present suffering not as inherent evil, but as chastening for the betterment of our life. And given that the mass of humanity seems to have little interest in utilizing freedom for anything other than their own comfort, why not just accept the Grand Inquisitor's bargain? Maybe he's right. If he is right, there are not just existential ramifications, but surely also political ramifications. As I said, the rest of the novel is an answer to Ivan and the Grand Inquisitor's charge. The novel does not attempt to answer Ivan's charge through logical argument, but instead through life and actions. I suspect that Dostoevsky did not put arguments, premises, deductions, and logic into the mouths of his heroes because his ideological opponents could care less about such arguments. Their concern was this plane, this existence, this world, and thus Dostoevsky would answer them on this plane, this existence, this world. The Brother Karamazov counters the Grand Inquisitor by showing how life itself, the psychology, spirit, and hope of humanity resist the Grand Inquisitor's solution. Or rather, to accept Ivan's rebellion is to rebel not just against the nature of God's creation, but against our own humanity. I will say this, and then promptly forget it, those of you who have not read the full book. Ivan, we follow Ivan's thoughts the rest of the book, and he slowly decays. I mean, he remains behind these kind of black iron bars of his logic, and we just see his psyche slowly disintegrate until he's bordering on madness near the end of the novel. The Elder Zosima is the beginning of Dostoevsky's answer to Ivan and the Grand Inquisitor. The Elder Zosima embodies the alternative, a love of life and a joyful devotion to God. Whereas Ivan rejects God's world, the Elder Zosima accepts it. Twice in the novel, he bows and he kisses the earth, saying, "Kiss the earth. Love it tirelessly, insatiably. Love all men. Love all things. Do not be ashamed." Alyosha, who is Elder Zosima's pupil, will later kiss the earth, imitating his spiritual father. The Elder Zosima tells his story of his own youthful rebellion. As a young man, he rejected killing a man in a duel and instead exclaims, "Look at the divine gifts all around us, the clear sky, the fresh air, the tender grass, the birds. Nature is beautiful and sinless, and we alone are godless and foolish and do not understand that life is a paradise. For we need only to wish to understand, and it will come to us at once in all its beauty, and we shall embrace the other and weep." If the Grand Inquisitor mimics the devil of Christ's temptation in the desert, remember how the Grand Inquisitor urges Christ to turn these bread into stone? Dostoevsky is very conscientiously reflecting the story of the devil coming to Christ in the desert. If the Inquisitor mimics the devil of Christ's temptation, the Elder Zosima mimics the Christ of the Beatitudes. If a criminal should mock you, do not desire vengeance, and trust that his self-chastisement will eventually occur. Let your light shine before men, yet when you see that men are not saved by it, hold firm and doubt not the power of the heavenly light. Do not share the pride of Satan, he says, by murmuring against God as Ivan had done. Do you guys notice that the Elder Zosima, the scripture that he quotes from, that he's most interested in, is the book of Job, which is, of course, the direct response or the direct contemplation of the nature of evil in this world. And it's the one that Zosima hearkens to. There's a link, says the Elder, between this world and heaven. One that once that link is forgotten, humanity will slump into indifference and hatred of their own life. Quote, God took seeds from different worlds, sowed them on the earth, but what grows is alive only through that feeling of its contact with other mysterious worlds. Once such contact is lost, then you will be indifferent to life and even grow to hate it. Zosima says, indirectly about the socialists, that they rely on reason alone to teach unity and solidarity, and that their view is more fantastical than ours. They aim at justice, but denying Christ, they will end flooding the earth with their blood. The Elder believes that Russia, who is long scorned for not being enlightened like the rest of Europe, will shine forth to the world and will become, through Christ, the stone which the builders rejected and will become its chief cornerstone. One year after Dostoevsky published The Brothers Karamazov, which was a wild success, he was at the end of his life very, very popular. And as David said earlier, his novels are sort of a public debate about what the direction of Russia will be. In January of 1881, the morning of January 28th, his wife Anna woke up to find him wide awake, and when she asked what the matter was, he told her that he was going to die. In fact, he was going to die that very day. She told him to not talk nonsense, but later in that day, he asked his wife to read to him from the Bible that he had received on his way to prison. And she read the parable of the prodigal son. That evening at 11:38, he hemorrhaged again, lost consciousness, and died. Despite his literary efforts that today are measured against Tolstoy, Dante, and Milton, his fears for Russia came true. 1 month after his death in February of 1881, Tsar Alexander II would be assassinated, and 25 years after that assassination, bloody uprisings would occur throughout Russia, culminating with the 1917 revolution. And Russia was delivered to Marxism, atheism, and the other isms imported from the West. The spiritual and purely Russian salvation that Dostoevsky dreamed for his nation was not realized, but his prescient observations have hailed many people to not just refer to him as a fiction writer, but as a prophet. In fact, the last volume of the 5-volume set by Joseph Frank is entitled The Mantle of the Prophet.